A couple of pre-announcements, I guess. Firstly, of course, I want to thank our sponsors this evening, Yaakov and Diane Burstein, sponsoring in memory of Diane's beloved grandfather, Louis Kravitz, Oliver Shalom, and her uncle, Seymour Kravitz. Oliver Shalom to Chaim Adel Itzkowitz, sponsoring a memory of Adele's beloved grandfather, Harry Stein, Gottsfried Ben Yaakov, Oliver Shalom, and Asher and Pessy Reimer, sponsoring a memory of Pessy's beloved father, Jack Singer, Avram Yaakov, Ben Arav Eliyahu, Oliver Shalom as well. I want to wish Neshamot Aliyot, thank the sponsors, of course, wish them comfort and well, that our learning this evening should be in the memory of their loved ones, and their memory should be a blessing. So that was announcement, I guess, number one, to thank the sponsor for this evening. Announcement number two, I imagine a number of you received an email an hour ago or so, which I did as well, which came as a pleasant surprise. It is always good to find things out on email. I'm kidding. Of course, I found out far before that, announcing that my contract had been renewed by the membership, and I just want to take, there'll be plenty of time, please God, to touch on this and offer thanks and gratitude. But this is the first time, I guess, I have the chance to speak to more than just Miriam or Sammy or my parents about this. So I want to thank very, very much Sammy for all his hard work from beginning to end. Of course, going back, the search committee, the contract committee, the board, the lay leadership, friends, which I consider all of you. Miriam, myself, the kids feel just incredibly blessed to be part of this community. We feel very deeply attached to all of you and couldn't imagine being anywhere else for 7 years. So we feel very blessed and grateful and look forward, please God, to having many, many occasions where we get to continue virtual programming and see each other in person and celebrate together and return to a state where we can come to each other's houses and have deep, meaningful conversation over cups of tea or, if you insist, coffee or, you know, maybe we'll have a whiskey. We'll see. And I also, as a signal of how grateful I am, I don't want to drop any names. Number one, I don't want to embarrass anybody in case I'm wrong, but you've noticed it snowed a lot. Somebody, my secret Santa, when I just realized I'm being recorded, so I shouldn't say Santa, but my secret Maccabee has been plowing the front of my house or shoveling the front of my house. I'm not going to drop names, but I think they are on this call right now. So if they know who they are, I want to thank them very, very much. I know it's not easy to go out in these conditions, and I don't have a snow blower. I tried blowing the snow. That didn't do anything. So I want to thank you for your efforts very, very much, because it's been happening a few times. I thought it was my landlord who was doing it, and I was going to send him a very nice thank you. So I'm glad I didn't, because it turns out it wasn't him. So thank you. Okay, we turn... Was that a question? Was it you, Saul?
Nope.
Yeah, I know. Thank you anyway. And by the way, Esther, I haven't forgotten I owe you a kiddush for you guessing Jefferson's handwriting about 4 months ago. So are you and John Kramer kiddush? We'll do the kiddush when kiddushim return.
We'll make it together, me and John. We go way back anyway.
Right. Okay, good. Well, I'll have to do something. I did. I gave my word, which I will not do again. So I have learned from the experience. Okay, so let's turn to Parashat Mishpatim. And it is a very awkward turn, a very sudden shift from what has been, from the beginning of Shemot, increasingly dramatic, from the opening psukim of the book, which introduce us very slowly, ease us into the state the Jews were in. We're reminded that the 12 tribes came down, 70 souls, that Yosef was in charge, and then slowly the luxury, the comfort, the security ebbed away as Jews increased in population. They also became distasteful in the eyes of the Egyptians, and then slowly were incarcerated into service. Herzbergs, welcome back. Lovely to see you. When did you get back?
What's today?
Good question.
Yesterday morning.
Welcome back. I'm sure you're jet lagged, so I'll try to make this as dramatic as possible, but lovely to see you. Welcome
Thank
back.
Thank you.
So we had slavery began. We had dramatic moments where Moshe bursts onto the scene. The first thing we hear about him slaughtering an Egyptian to save a Jew. In that moment, we still don't know if he really knows he's Jewish, despite the fact that we're told that he went to see his brothers. We're not sure how he knows that. We don't know how he was raised. We don't know what he learned. We don't know what his personality is like. All we know is his first public known act is essentially an execution. An act of defense for the vulnerable, but also an aggressive act. He flees after trying to control the Jews, who turn around and say to him, "Who on earth do you think you are?" Which in itself tells me something about the Jewish character, who as slaves turn to a prince and think they've got an one up on him and say, who do you think you are? We're going to tell everybody your secret. And from that fleeing, Moshe then finds peace in the desert, meets God, comes back to Egypt under instruction to free the people, has some miraculous gestures to show Pharaoh to prove his mission. Pharaoh scoffs, increases the burden on the Jews. And this is just the first parasha. We then have parasha Shmot, Va'era, Bo. So the next two parashas are the 10 plagues, which don't need me to dramatize them. They are terrifying. They are comprehensive. They dismantle the empire. They dismantle Egyptian theology. They give a sense of earth-shattering consequences to the ancient Near East, that God means business, that Israel is a chosen people, and that the vulnerable need to be protected. And that is going to be a theme of this week's Parsha Mishpatim, where we have a smattering of laws, but a repetitive pattern of protecting the orphan, protecting the widow, protecting the stranger, because we were strangers in Egypt, just within living memory of being slaves to a people. We are told to remember that we were treated badly by them, and we should not treat others, because it's almost understandable that we were mistreated by them. It's a natural instinct to be treated badly when you're in a foreign land, and we need to remember what that felt like, almost ensuring that we understood slavery as a necessary lesson of some sort. So the vulnerable is going to be the lessons of vulnerability is going to be key. Then after we had the 10 plagues, of course, Parsha Bashalach, we leave, the sea is split. They walk through an ocean, they stave off an attack from Amalek with Moses' hands in the sky. We head from Bashalach and the song of the sea into Parsha Yitro, where again, the earth literally shakes, a mountain smokes like an oven, we're told, and God's voice bellows through the cosmos. And then we get to Mishpatim. And it is jarring how we go from, maybe I did too much Ten Commandments last week. There's nothing I can do for the Ten Commandments this week because the movie's over. It ends. And I should say, it doesn't end with them at Har Sinai. How does it end, the Ten Commandments, the movie? What is the final thing that happens? Anyone remember the end of the movie?
The Eagle HaZahav.
Well, the Eagle HaZahav, I think that was Seth. You're right, that is the kind of the final dramatic episode. But if I remember correctly, the kind of the voiceover before it goes to the credits is, and Joshua led the people away from the mountain and over the Jordan and into the land. We've hit 40 years of the desert, but what Cecil B. DeMille suggests is, yeah, we hit the main points. We got the drama, we got the sea, we got the plagues, we got the mountain, we got the golden calf. And then Joshua took them into the land, and there were some hiccups along the way. There was a foreign prophet, Bilam, the little uprising with Korach, but we hit the main notes. And nowhere, of course, is to be seen of the details of Mishpatim. And actually, what's surprising each year about Mishpatim is the misconception that Mishpatim is just laws, and there's no narrative. But actually, the last two Aliyot, Shishi and Shvi'i, are narratives where God makes promises, he speaks to the people, the elders respond in certain ways, and actually it sets up the rest of Shemot. It is the moment where Moshe ascends the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. That hasn't happened yet. In the chronology of the text, the Ten Commandments were given, there was drama, but Moshe hasn't written out the Torah yet. He's going to have that dictated beginning at the end of this week's parasha, and of course that 40-day gap is going to lead to the troubles that Seth referenced in the Ten Commandments will come there. In the same way that Parashat Yitro, so much of the drama is left to Shishi and Shvi, but that occupies the center stage. Shishi and Shvi and Mishpatim, I think we've all been so ground down by the first five Aliyot of civil torts and criminal law, we're just out for the count. But there's actually quite a lot of excitement and attention to give toward the end. And in fact, I'll probably draw on a moment from the end in the Drasha on Shabbos, if I find some time this evening to put it on paper. That's probably where I'll put my attention. So let's have a think about Mishpatim. It is literally, Mishpatim means laws. What is a Mishpat as opposed to a Chok or a Mitzvah traditionally?
There's an explanation.
Right. Usually we contrast mitzvah is kind of a generic term for a command, and usually we contrast chukim and mishpatim. And they're actually two parashiot taking those names, chukat and mishpatim. Chukat doesn't come up till Bamidbar, with the central chok being the para aduma, which we'll talk about when we get to chukat. But here we have Mishpatim, which are, as Seth indicates, a set of reasonable laws that we can understand, we can comprehend. Don't kill, don't steal, don't harm, pay on time, don't abuse, don't exploit. Kind of the civil laws that we can imagine almost any legislature passing. So what are these laws? And as I'll just kind of list off some of these laws, we'll maybe talk about some of them along the way. And I invite you, of course, to jump in if you have any thoughts. But one of the most difficult things to try and accomplish is to figure out a structure here, an order. How do we flow from one law to the next? In fact, in my drasha last year, I did offer one reading of the structure. And this is not a test to see if anybody remembers, because I won't remember unless I look at what I wrote. But there's fascinating observations about how do we understand the flow from one halacha, from one mitzvah to the next. So in Rishon, it begins almost astonishingly, or perhaps not, with the laws of avadim, of servants and maidservants, indentured slaves, which I actually noted on Sunday in Shul between Min Chamar, we're doing Sefer Achinuch, and it happened to coincide with the mitzvah, the first one for Mishpatim, has been rather controversial. The Torah seems to endorse the infrastructure of slavery. The institution of slavery is cemented into biblical law. Is that good or bad? Gut instinct.
Depends how you set up the parameters.
Okay, interesting. Depends how you set up the parameters. Say again, is that, I see the name Moshe. Who's speaking?
Me.
Oh, it's me. Okay, go on, me.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't hear what you said. Did you say slavery was good or bad?
It's bad.
Bad. Right. So, oh, there you are. Hello. Good to see you. So, slavery, you're right. Our instinct is slavery is bad. Saul suggests, well, maybe it depends how it's set up. How could we set it up to be good, Saul? Let's put it like that.
in the way it is structurally set up, that it is an obligation of the owner to the slave, not so much the slave to the owner.
Interesting. So let me ask another question. Does slavery exist in the United States today? Some people would argue economic slavery. Okay, interesting. Harold, you were going to say the same thing?
Yes.
So what do you mean by economic slavery? What, devil's advocate, what would people who suggest that, what are they referring to? Do you mean people who have to work like 4 part-time jobs to make a living? Is that what you're referring to?
Basically, yes.
Okay, interesting.
Or people who are living in a situation. Yeah, that's really what it comes down to, where you're living in a place where your rent is so high that you have to work 4 or 5 jobs to be able to go and pay your rent and put food on the table.
Okay, interesting. So I guess the argument could be made that you could make the argument that there's economic disparity, that there's a fundamental injustice in the economic system. Slavery, my sense in that context, would be more of an emotional claim. It would be hyperbolic in the sense, how do we define slavery? Slavery would be work without pay against your will, right? If that's a kind of, we use a technical definition, work without pay against your will, I think people who are in desperate situations, as you say, where they have to work 5 part-time jobs, and all administrations get to say, look, I created 4 million jobs. And no one says, well, 3 of the million jobs you created are part-time jobs that people don't get paid well for. But right, so you could say it's economic injustice, perhaps, and there needs to be intervention. But the technical term of slavery, they are being paid. And it's not quite against their will, as if they could decide to try go somewhere else. Or I know families living in New York's incredibly expensive. They were finding it very difficult to make a living. And they decided, you know what, I'm going to pack up and I'm going to move to somewhere in the middle of the country where I'll find a small Jewish community where I'll get paid essentially the same and my rent will be a third and it'll be more livable. And I'm not suggesting that it's easy to do that. It's incredibly hard to do that. But in theory, technical term of slavery, it's hard to put that into. So does the technical definition of slavery work without pay against your will, does that exist in the United States today?
Only for illegal aliens. Other than that, no.
Okay, interesting. So there's an argument to be made that kind of off the books that exists. And the truth is, I don't work for the United Nations.
What I'm talking about is this. There are certain people who will pay to be brought across the country, brought across the border, and they wind up being in slavery because they have to pay off the fee for being brought in, and there's no way they can ever pay that off.
Right. So as I was going to say,
that's not part of our system. It's outside of our system. Okay.
Right. So does it exist in the United States? So the answer would be yes. Not that it's instituted in the United States, but it exists. I'm not an expert. I don't know the statistical numbers. I've seen, Law and Order, and I've seen Madam Secretary, and I've seen the dramatization of these figures who kind of live off the books in the shadows, that people end up having these people living in their homes and no one ever sees, and they don't pay them and they make them work and they tell them, if you don't do your work, I'm just going to call ICE, and then farewell, back to your horrific circumstance. So I can't say factually, I know the cases, I've spoken to the detectives, but it's somewhat common knowledge that this exists. And the reports are, of course, across the world. Slavery, human trafficking exists. So it exists off the book. Does it exist anywhere? And I'm trying to do this in a non-provocative way, just as an interesting reflection, whether slavery exists legally in America today. And I am saying it in provocative terms, I guess, because if when I tell you what I'm referring to, you're going to say, that's not slavery. But does work against your will without pay exist in the United States?
In the prison system.
There you go. So Alan suggests, well, hold on a minute. Almost the definition fits. People who are in prison, it depends on different prison, state, federal. I'm sure we've all heard of club, what's it called? Club Fed or Club Med, where they've got the Duff Yomi and the Minyanim somewhere where Michael Cohen wanted to go to prison. But there are many prison jail systems in the country where, you know, you don't get to put your feet up and do daf yomi. There, I don't know how many of you saw Shawshank Redemption. You tend to get assigned jobs. I think proportionally 90% of license plates in America are made in prisons. There are different industries that essentially, they don't get a salary for that, right? They get, I guess, room and board, if you want to call.
They do get a salary. They usually get paid 35 cents an hour.
They are paid?
Around 35 cents an hour.
All right. So I didn't realize that. I thought it was just, you're in jail, be useful, and we'll feed you and give you a roof. Okay, interesting. So maybe it doesn't quite hit the definition of slavery, although 35 cents an hour doesn't go very far. And that might be a technical way of avoiding it being slavery. But the point I would make in reference to this is not to say we should abolish the jails, but we should see the biblical slavery in that context, because we're not talking about a system where you buy and sell human beings on the street. The avdut system here are people who have committed crimes who don't have the money to pay it back. And this is essentially a prison term, but not often a jail somewhere where you make license plates, but in the home of the people you stole from or you can't get pay back. And I mean, it is an astonishing system where the person who stole from me or doesn't pay me back gets to live in my
home. Rabbi?
Yeah.
Why go so far afield? When you commit yourself to chinuch and yeshiva education, that's as close to slavery as you're going to get these days. Your main commitment in your life is going to be to pay for yeshiva education.
There you go. So there we've got also an off the books. I didn't realize so much slavery existed. It's true. We've got self-imposed slavery. It is true. So, and when seen in this way, and I want to try and be clear, I'm not trying to undermine the moral weight that comes with the term slavery. When we say, does slavery exist in America? I think we all understand the weight of that term. And what I'm trying to do is distinguish the biblical description of slavery, which was used by pro-slavery Southern Americans defending the system, said this is enshrined in the biblical text. Don't you Yankees, I think that was a name for Northerners, right? Yes. I don't know why, yes. By the way. Not sure what Yankee was referencing. Anybody know? All right, well, homework. So they said, don't you come and tell us that we can't do this, it's immoral. Take it upstairs. Talk to God about it. He put in the book of Exodus. This is how you have slaves. It's clearly permitted. And there, of course, Northerners suggested we have to understand the text differently, or we have to, or that's the Old Testament, and however they dealt with that. And there's a fascinating book that name escaped me that maybe somebody will remember. I think it's called Exodus and Emancipation, put together contrasting the reactions of Jews. One of the chapters is designated to how rabbis reacted to the emancipation and the Civil War at the time, where you had Northern congregations preaching against slavery, Southern congregations defending the Confederacy. There was one rabbi in the South who preached against the Confederacy and against slavery. They did not extend his contract, and he got booted up and he went to the North. I think David Levy was the name. You can check it up. He was a reform rabbi. I don't remember his name, David something. But the beginning of our parasha this week has been used, abused, exploited, employed in the service of defending slavery and not. Chief Rabbi Hertz, are you familiar with Chief Rabbi Hertz? I'm sure many of you have seen the Hertz Chumash. That for the longest time before Art Scroll was around was one of the main English translation. So his opening sentence commentary on the opening of Mishpatim is biblical slavery has nothing to do with what we call modern day slavery. It's an entirely different system, which is kind of what I was referring to in terms of does slavery exist today? Yeah, we have systems where people work against their will without really, I won't say without being paid, but without really being paid. And that's what Avdut was. The Avdut that we got in Egypt was not the same. It was not a repayment system. It wasn't a criminal justice system. It was just a system of injustice. The prison system may be in need of reform. There may be other avenues to dole out punishment, rehabilitation efforts. But to some degree, the model in Mishpatim is an attempt at a criminal justice system that is rehabilitative. There are mandatory maximums as opposed to mandatory minimums, where 6 years maximums go free in the seven. And if they demand they want to stay, we actually have to pierce their ear in the wall. It's not a good thing. We want you to become independent. We want you to return and be productive members of society on your own two feet. We want you to be a servant of God, not a servant of other people. So that's Hurst's first response. There are others as well, but I'm sorry, I think I interrupted someone.
No, just a question. So, okay, so that's the first paragraph of Mishpatim. But the second paragraph of Mishpatim, Kiyem Kor Ish et Bito Lama, Lo Teitse Kitse Ta'avadim. So what are we talking about there? That's not from a criminal, that's not from a crime, I don't think, or is it? Maybe I'm misunderstanding what it is. But it seems to say that a person, if he's poor, can actually sell one of his daughters into slavery.
Yeah, this it gets harder and harder to swallow from a modern perspective. And when I kind of skirt the issue and just talk about slavery writ large, I can get around it. But you're right. There are instantly, as we start this parasha, there are culture gaps that strike us as odd, that a father can sell their daughter for slavery. And actually what I noted, the Sefer Achinuch, the medieval anthologer who puts together the mitzvot from the parasha, he kind of sits down with the parasha and he says, I'll assemble all the mitzvot that come up in this week's parasha, adding up to 613. So there are a number of parashiot in Bereshit that he leaves blank. There are only like three or four mitzvot in Bereshit. There's Peru Uvu, Brit Milah, Gid Hanasher, one more that I'm blanking on. You'll remember. And then we head to Shmot. So he only does a mitzvot. And in this week's parasha, he begins with Avdut. And one of the unique things that Sefer Chinuch does, he doesn't just assemble the mitzvot, he gives you what's called the shoresh of the mitzvot. He tries to give some philosophical underpinning. What does God want to achieve? Of course, he begins by saying, when we're given a mitzvot, we don't really get the luxury of asking why. But if it helps us in our observance and helps us as human beings come to terms with our practice, I'll give you the shoresh, a root of all the mitzvah. And he says, what's the root of the mitzvah of avdut? Rachamim. And it's just bracing. He says, the whole point of this mitzvah is to teach us rachamim. And I'll come to a point about the young girl in a minute, Harold. He says, it's teaching us rachamim because, and this is the point that Rav Hirsch makes, not Rav Hertz, Chief Rabbi Hertz, but Rav Hirsch, is that at the time, economies were powered by human markets. They had slavery. It was inexorable. It was part of the ancient system of barter and ownership and hierarchy, that there were princes and emperors and servants and slaves and farmers and common folk. And part of the economies were pinned on the slave market. And Hirsch says the Jewish system was set up because in the ancient world, if you were branded a slave, there was no way to enter society. You were a slave. Your children would be slaves in perpetuity. You were branded from a young age, and that was the end of your productive existence. You'd never have freedom or independence. And the system of what we call avdut, or indentured servitude in Jewish life, was essentially, for him, a conduit to freedom. It was a way for people to come under Jewish control. We could purchase them as slaves, then enter the Jewish system so we could rehabilitate them and free them. And that's what slavery was intended to do. And the whole point of the structures and the institutions of avdut were to train us to have compassion on our slaves. For example, the most famous thing that everybody throws around about slavery in the Jewish context is, how do we know that slaves have to be treated well?
Pillow.
There you go, the pillow. Everybody throws around the pillow, right. And this is Tosfot, the medieval commentator, says, if in your home you have one pillow, who gets it? And I asked this on Sunday night, and Arnie Mandelstam said, the wife. That's true. You've got one pillow in the home, the wife gets it. So you've got two pillows in the home. Who gets it? The wife and?
The slave.
The slave. And you don't get it. Meaning the system of avdut was set up so that we would ensure to treat those under our care, under our dominion, with a level of humanity and compassion. And at some intuitive level, it doesn't even feel like a stretch to say that. Because if there was found somewhere in the recesses of Bamidbar or Devarim, you could say, this seems ambiguous, unjust, very odd and strange. But coming off, literally off the boat, well, not literally, coming out of the sea from Egypt, it is inconceivable that the Jewish people, as a nation of slaves, would come out and then be told, oh, by the way, slavery is not bad. It's just unfortunate you were the slave. But here's the system, go for it. This, it makes far more logical, reasonable, rational sense that as they leave Egypt, they're given a system that says, look, what you just experienced for more than two centuries was the epitome of injustice. And I know there are economic systems, there should be criminal justice systems, but if you are going to set one up, this is how it needs to work, where there is inbuilt humanity to those who are conscripted into service as a means of penalty or personal redemption. Now, Harold's point was, I get that if someone's a criminal, if somebody owes money, but somebody we say can sell their daughter as a maidservant against her will, so to speak. And the psukim continue to say that the master, so to speak, the owner, then has a mitzvah called yiud, which is to marry the young girl when she comes of age. And this is where the Sefer Chinuch says, and this is also about rachamim. And he kind of sees it somewhat strangely as a solution to a shidduch crisis for the lower socioeconomic classes. That if somebody's in a place where they need to sell their daughter so that he thinks that she'll be cared for, that she'll have a good life, he can't afford to protect her, he's never going to be able to find a match for her, so I'll sell her to a wealthy family, and I know now that she's going to have a good life, because there's a mitzvah on the owners to either marry the daughter himself or have his son marry her, and the Sefer Chinuch says this is a structured to be a system to help her up, to give a sense of rachamim to those who are socioeconomically vulnerable. Whether we buy that or not is up to us. As I'll say, there are other views of these systems. But that's a defense where it comes to these systems are set up for eternity, and they work differently. I'll say there are other views. Rav Nachum Rabinovich, who passed away nearly a year ago now, I think, just under a year ago, and a couple of others, Rabbi Sachs, who was a student of Rav Rabinovich, have suggested, Rabbi Lam says this on many occasions, that the Torah is essentially a system of moral seeds that were set and planted to evolve over time. And it was the intention of the biblical text, as Rav Rabinovich reads it, for the system of slavery to become redundant. It was built in a way that would make it fall apart, where it was unsustainable. If you have a system of slavery that runs economies, it usually has to be run for profit. Otherwise, businesses go out of business if they don't make money, if they're not profitable, if they're not structured to be successful businesses. And this was set up in a way to wean the people off over many generations off this system. That's the argument Rav Rabinovich gave. And it's a difficult argument to make, but he suggests that providence proves his point, that the fact that over time, over history, slavery has been abolished, it is now seen almost universally across humanity as an abhorrent immoral practice, it is providentially certifying this plan. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu released in the biblical text, these are the laws of Avdut, and I want them to fall apart. I'm putting them here because I want to wean you off this system. The same argument was made by Rabbi Lam about killing Amalek. Anybody know any Amalekites out of interest? If you do, don't hand out their address. Anybody know any Amalekites? People self-identifying Amalekites?
Come on.
Haman's a good one, but he hasn't been around for a while. But he is described as Ha'agagi, the tied to Amalek? Anyone know any current living Amalekites?
I have a neighbor.
You got a neighbor? All right. Actually, it's funny. People often send me a Heksha they see in the store. They send me a picture. Is this good, Rabbi, or not? And there was a list released at one point of all the Heksharim in New York, all the restaurants and what Heksha they're under, hundreds and hundreds. And there was one, maybe you know this, Rabbi. There's a Rabbi A. Malek. And when I first saw Rabbi A. Malek, I thought it was a joke. Turns out that it's Rabbi Malek. And his first name is like Aaron or something, and they just abbreviated Rabbi Amalek. So he wouldn't count. Other than Saul's neighbor, there are no self-identifying Amalekites I know about. There are homiletic takes on, well, Amalek identity changes depending on who the enemies of the Jews are. But Rabbi Lam has an article writing that Amalek was purposefully disintegrated by Providence. That when Sanherib mixed up all the nations, Chazal recognized that the genetic chain of Amalek has been destroyed. So, and Rabbi Lam claims, because God providentially doesn't want us to go around killing children because of their genetics. It's not just happenstance. We're lucky, thank God, we're not confronted with Amalekite babies that we would have an obligation to kill. God wanted it to be that way. In the old world, 3,000 years ago, if you didn't live, and this is actually taken from the words of Rafuk, if you didn't live like wolves, you died. It was tribal. There was internecine fights all the time. It was brutal. I don't know how many of you have got the chance, took the chance, or wanted to watch some of the news coverage of the impeachment proceedings in the last few days. And I'm sure some of you have seen some of the horrifying video footage from the riot at the Capitol. And some of the scenes that I in the news coverage, it was observed, it looks medieval. You've got people standing there with like crowbars smashing policemen in the head. And it's just, it is like, this is medieval. We don't operate like this anymore. This is how in the Middle East, savagery is carried out. And the observation of Rav Kook is, if you didn't respond to that kind of aggression with aggression, you just didn't survive. But the intention providentially was that humanity would improve over time, and there wouldn't be this practice of killing Amalek. And that's Rabbi Lam's, what he calls an unapologetic apologetic for the rules of Amalek and how it dissolved over time. Rav Rabinovich makes the same claim for Avdu. The challenge exegetically for this view is then what happens to these passages in Tanakh? You've got a number of paragraphs dedicated to these rules. Are they now redundant, not worth our study, not worth our time? They were here basically as a concession to history that has now been overcome. It's the same exegetical challenge that Maimonides and others have to overcome in the context of almost the whole of Vayikra, who claim korbanot are no longer going to be in effect when the Bet Mikdash comes back. Well, the third Bet Mikdash will have korban mincha, we'll have the agricultural offering, but we're not going to have anything beyond that. The challenge with that is, of course, what do you do with Vayikra now? And the question here would be, what do you do with these psukim? So we've seen a smattering of reactions. I said I was going to go through the different halachot and mitzvot. We did one of the 53. So in 4 minutes, let's go through. So we've got the laws of Avdu, which, as we said, is a controversial, complicated one, but worth exploring. We've got murder is prohibited. Hitting parents is prohibited under penalty of death, hitting parents. Kidnapping is prohibited. Insulting parents. You have to imagine a child reading this. You can't hit your parents. Fine, I won't hit them. Don't insult your parents. Oh, fine, I won't insult your parents either. Please, no insulting parents. Assault is outlawed and prohibited. Now it turns to your possessions. Not many of us own domesticated animals. I guess some of us have pets. Anybody got pets? Nobody who I can see online has any pets? Interesting. Anybody ever had a pet? What did you have, Harold? If you say a fish, I won't count it.
Gerbils.
Okay, so who had the most exotic pet? Gerbil is pretty good. Anyone had a more exotic pet than a gerbil?
Steve Fox has boa constrictors.
Who's got boa constrictors?
Steve Fox.
Oh, interesting. I hope they're in a cage. That's good. Ellie, what do you have?
I had a dog.
You had a dog. Okay, that's exotic. I had two terrapins growing up. Anyone know what a terrapin is?
It's a Chinese dog.
Say it again.
Turtle.
Yeah, they're little turtles. And I was incredibly creative as a young boy in naming my pets. And I had two terrapins. One was called Terry. I'll give you a guess what the other one was called.
Pin.
You got it. Terry and Pin. That lasted well. And I remember well the day when we took them on a walk to the local stream with my father, who had got fed up cleaning the tank out every week, and we just let them have a little swim. And then I came home and I said, where's Terry and Pin? I said, oh,
they ran away.
They're having a swim. It's okay. So they've been enjoying about a 25-year swim. I don't imagine they lasted beyond the week. But we did put in a whole thing of food that just drifted down the river, which they couldn't catch up with. But that was my exotic pet. But most of us don't own really pets. I mean, dogs, cats, I guess, they in theory can do harm. My sister, when we went out for a Shabbos lunch when we were kids, somebody's cat kind of scratched her face. She was fine, and she was teasing the cat. But putting that aside, there are rules about if your animal gores a human being, what you do about animal damage, theft, damages to agriculture, crops. In modern day terms, this would apply to technology. If you have malware, if your possessions do damage in some sort, we then turn our attention to judges, bribery, integrity on the bench, how to treat enemies. You have to assist enemies if their animals fall in on the road. How to treat the vulnerable comes up again and again, to treat the orphans and the widow, and how to treat the stranger. We mentioned bribery, Shemitah, Shabbat comes up, Avodah Zarah comes up, the three pilgrimage festivals come up, Korbanot, Bikurim do come up. And that's the first five portions. And then we have Shishi and Shavit. Shishi is essentially God promising the Jewish people. And this would be worth studying on its own. It's a very strange part of the narrative where God promises the Jewish people, I will send an angel with you to escort you to the land of Israel. And if you follow the angel, I will be an enemy to your enemy. Very interesting turn of phrase. I don't know why Hashem doesn't just say, I'll protect you. He says, I'll be an enemy to your enemies. Which, of course, an enemy to your enemy is your friends, but it's still an odd locution, which is worth studying. Then in Shavii, Hashem invites Moshe, Aaron, the elders to bow down before him. Moshe repeats the mitzvah, and then we have perhaps the two most famous words from the Jewish people in the context of Matan Torah. Naaseh v'nishma, which does not come up last week, but comes up at the end of this week after hearing all these laws. And then Moshe writes down the laws. He sprinkles blood all over the people, which I'm sure they were grateful for. They did korbanot, they had a mizbeach. And then the elders saw God, and then we're told they sat down to have a meal. They ate and drank, which is seen as an error on their part. And then cloud descends on Mount Sinai, and Moshe ascends and enters into the cloud for 40 days and 40 nights. And that sets up nicely the coming few weeks. It's 9:01. We were going to put a little pressure over the conjunction between last week and this week, actually. But we'll leave that for another time. I thank you for that productive discussion. And we'll give more attention to different elements of this on future years. I see something in the chat. Oh, we'll get to that another time, too. But in the meantime, I will open the floor, any observations, questions, thoughts, but beyond that, wish you all a Shabbat Shalom. I will note that this coming Monday night, 8:15, there will be the first part of a two-part series on Megillah Esther, which will finish sharply at 9:00. I think there will be a board meeting that I need to end on time at 9:00, so that'll happen on Monday night. Otherwise, it's Rosh Chodesh. So I want to wish you all a Chodesh Tov. and a very, very happy Adar to come, and may this Adar begin a year ahead of happiness and celebration and togetherness and community, so that, please God, next Purim, the only masks we'll be wearing will be over our eyes. That is my hope. And I want to wish you all a restful Shabbos, a healthy Shabbos, and good to see you all.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Marvin Bissim.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Marvin
Bissim. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night.
Thank you.
Good night, everybody.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Rabbi, where can I find your recorded shiurim? Like I missed last week. Where is that recording available?
The Parsha one?
Yeah.
Good question. It is in the cloud at the moment. Not the one that Moshe went into, but a different one. But I will take it out of the cloud. And hopefully it won't take 40 days and 40 nights. But I'll put it up on YU Torah as I sign off now. So it should be available. And I'll try and do that relatively regularly. Keep people on their toes. All right. Good night, everybody.
Have a good night.
Good night. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Good night, everybody.